this is Rachel Lynn, and you are listening to Upstage Left. In this episode, I speak with actor, playwright, and Asian child my mother wished she had, Daniel K. Isaac. Daniel is currently starring opposite Linda Lavin in Noah Diaz's You Will Get Sick at the Roundabout Theater Company. His play Once Upon a Korean Time world premiered at La Mama this fall, and he was also nominated for a 2022 Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Featured Actor in a Play for his portrayal of Atung in Lloyd Suh's The Chinese Lady. Did I mention that he's also shot 6 seasons of Billions and about to shoot season 7? Researching Daniel, I felt like, oh, I have the same number of hours in the day as Beyoncé and Daniel K. Isaac. He is seriously so prolific as a writer, as an actor. I was super inspired to talk to him about his process and what he does and how he's gotten to where he is. And I hope that you'll get a lot out of our conversation as well. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. If you like the episode, share it with a friend, share it with a Billions fan. Yeah, here is Daniel K. Isaac. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
I am so excited. This interview has been 6 months in the making.
Truly, since The Chinese Lady at the Public Theater, right?
That's right. Yeah, since The Chinese Lady. Right after I saw it, I emailed you. And the amazing thing that you wrote me back was, you wrote back, I don't know that I have that much to contribute these days as I'm in between projects, but if you think you can get a decent interview out of me, I'm happy to support. That is so hilarious, considering how insanely busy you are. Just so people know, if you don't already, Daniel just finished shooting season 6 of Billions. You got a Drama Desk nom for The Chinese Lady. Your play that you wrote, Once Upon a Korean Time, just world premiered at La Mama. You're currently in rehearsals for Noah Diaz's You Will Get Sick at the Roundabout. And I don't know, a million other things you're doing. So like, as I was preparing for this interview, all I could think was, if we had a imaginary Chinese mother, she would be like, Rachel, what are you doing? Why are you not as good as your brother, Daniel? Like, be like Daniel, be more like Daniel. Yeah.
The same mother would also be like, why aren't you married with children yet? So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she would say the same thing to me too, but you also got married this summer. So you're really.
We had a commitment ceremony, but yeah. Same difference. It's been a year. It's been a lot. I hope people aren't too annoyed with me on social media for just begging them to come see all these shows.
I mean, no, I don't think anyone ever could be. I'm so amazing. So much amazing stuff. How do you feel?
I feel immense gratitude and maybe a lot of fatigue because today is my first day off in a little bit, or this half of the day is now my day off. Mm-hmm. So, but it is wild to look back on and think, oh, wow, this all happened in this year, in the midst of an ongoing pandemic and all the other uncertainties of life. 2022 has been a busy year in which I will look back and wonder, how did you do that? And be very thankful for all the patient friends and family around me. Because I'm sure what I've had to sacrifice is interpersonal relationships in pursuit of career. Or I just miss my friends. That was my fancy way of saying I miss my friends. But, you know, every project we do, that becomes an immediate family too. And so I'm very grateful for all these little families that have come together this year.
Yeah. And it seems like you work with the same people. I mean, Ralph directed the play you wrote, but he also directed Chinese Lady. So,
that's nice. I love that frequent collaborator kind of shorthand. I think that's a real luxury that probably we don't often get, especially as Asian American artists, if we're usually in like tokenized or individual slots of things. To get to work with Ralph multiple times over multiple years now, I don't know that I've ever had a collaborator like that. I'm super, super grateful.
Yeah. Because when was the first workshop of Chinese Lady?
Shannon and I never workshopped it. And so she and I just cold auditioned in, that would have been 2018. And Shannon, Tayo, and I had never met each other prior to then either, even though we'd been in the city for a bit. And so we all kind of did our own little sleuthing, and everyone kept saying, Shannon's amazing. You're going to love Shannon. How do you not know Shannon? And that's how we came together first day of rehearsal. I think it was a summer rehearsal because we did a joint world premiere with Barrington Stage and Mai Theater Company. So we rehearsed in New York, then went up to the Berkshires, did the show there during the summer, and then brought it back to New York City that fall. So Shannon and I had a long 2018 together, including living together up in the Berkshires and hiking. And I made her lactose intolerant for the summer because I'm dairy-free. And so we had a dairy-free household. One day she had like a cappuccino or a latte and thought she was going through something or a panic attack on stage. And then later we realized it was just dairy poisoning. We'd lived together for so long by that point that she wasn't having any dairy. And then she introduced it that it was like a two-show day and she couldn't figure out what was happening to her body.
Oh, wow.
I think she's since gone back to eating plenty of dairy and drinking plenty of dairy, but I just remembered that.
Yeah. Okay, well, good to know. If you do a show with Daniel, you may discover.
You will become lactose intolerant.
Very common for Asians, though, I have read. That's amazing. So that show happened in 2018, and then 4 years later, you do it again. Was it supposed to go up earlier at the Public, or did it just get pushed back?
I imagine so. Yeah, 2020, they were doing a production, which would have been the second production that Ralph was going to direct of it at Long Wharf Theater. And they were in tech, I believe, when all the shutdowns happened across the country. And I couldn't do that production because I was shooting Billion season 5 at that time. So I couldn't go out of the city or state really for that long. And John Norman Schneider played the Atong role with Shannon. And they were able to come back when theaters were reopening in 2021 to do it. And I got to go see them do that. And it must have been late 2020 or 2021 that the Public wanted to co-produce with Mai Yi and bring back the Chinese Lady to the city, because our run in 2018 in the city had been very short because, you know, small theater companies and it's expensive to produce theater and it's such a risk, especially with new work. And we were fortunate with a hit, but they hadn't budgeted for extensions during that 2018 run. And it felt like another right time to do the play again anyway. So then Shannon and I and John Norman Schneider and Cindy M, with Shannon's understudy, got to do it at the Public this year. So that's a long journey from 2018 to 2022.
Yeah. And a challenging role. Atong doesn't say a lot. I realized watching it, I don't think I had ever seen you perform before. I knew you as a writer first because you've been a part of Young Blood since 2017. And I think that's where I came to know you. And yeah, I was really struck by your voice. You have an incredible voice. I'm sure you get that a lot.
Thank you.
But now that we're just talking about it, I'm so curious. What was your relationship to that role and developing it? And that character has such a strong relationship to the audience. How did you develop that through the run?
Yeah. I will forever be indebted to Ralph and Shannon and Lloyd. And how we were able to create that piece and how collaborative, but also just creative and special that was. I had done a different two-hander in 2018 called The Gentleman Caller by Philip Dawkins. And so I jokingly said 2018 was my year of two-handers. And that one, they were just very different experiences. And that play had been done before, whereas we were the world premiere version. And I just think there's an incredible privilege to having a living playwright in the room. And the way Shannon and Lloyd would work together was really remarkable, and I felt the need to serve Lloyd and Ralph's vision, but mostly to support Shannon, and in being a scene partner that wasn't always audibly there or, mm-hmm. you know, with lines and pure dialogue there, but psychically connected, and in a format in which the way we were staged was such that my character's back was always turned to her, but I always sort of felt like we had this kind of umbilical cord between us that I don't know that I've experienced before or after, and forever will love Shannon for this. The development of the character was more, I guess, it was easy to bring a lot of myself in his secondary nature, or if there's a lot of things being explored about the Asian female body in America, there's also a lot being said of the Asian male body in America in this role. Mm. And that's not something I'm unfamiliar with, whether it is neutering or silencing or desexualizing or imprinting upon rather than giving voice to. And so I'll always carry Atung with me and have his sort of secret inner world and rebellion as much as support and survival or resiliency. Yeah.
Did you ever worry about non-Asian, and I'll just say like white audiences receiving that character and this piece? Did you ever worry about them not understanding or just enjoying it on a kind of reinforcing a stereotype or a story?
I think what Lloyd has masterfully done is in, this is a spoiler, but also people, I hope, have seen it or will encounter it, and you can still experience it knowing this, but because it moves forward in time to a present day of sorts or whatever is directed as the final scene, I don't think an audience is allowed to leave patting themselves on the back for what happened to her and her disappearance and the way she posits the audience and their relationship to this piece of American history. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would say that a difference in when we did it in 2018 versus 2022 that Shannon and I would always talk about was that in 2018, it was like we had to convince the majority of the audience that to be an Asian body in America could be a place of disadvantage and a place that experiences racism and struggle and prejudice and violence. And yet it wasn't until China virus or COVID-related Asian hate crime incidents and the rhetoric from our previous president and the statistics that I think were actually always there, but calling them in a way that made more folks outside of the community aware that violence against Asian bodies were escalating at an alarming rate. That meant that we could perform the show before an audience, and it seemed like they understood more that there were stakes here that prior to that, they maybe lived in the, you're a model minority who's experienced much success in this country. What right do you have to complain? What privilege you have? Why are you even doing this play, or why this story? Why now? Mm-hmm. And instead, I think in the power of theater and storytelling and in the urgency with which my theater company brought it and Ralph directed it and what Lloyd has gifted, it was ahead of its time. And then unfortunately and brilliantly is speaking to its time. And I imagine will continue to, even if, say, hate crimes against Asian bodies rapidly or drastically diminish. I think the play's relevance echoes beyond, which is sort of a masterful thing that Lloyd has done that still blows my mind.
It's interesting to think about this play in the context of 2018-2019, because that's the year that the AIPAC visibility report is based on. It's a report that came out during the pandemic that said only 6.3% of the roles that were cast in that off-Broadway, Broadway season were cast with Asian American actors. Mm-hmm. And so Chinese Lady is part of that 6.3%, I believe. Mm-hmm. And thinking about that versus this season, the 2022-2023 season, where we had Your Play, Once Upon a Korean Time, we're seeing Peerless this year, we're seeing Good Enemy by Yilong Liu, we're seeing more roles and stories with Asians or about Asian people, and you starring in Noah Diaz's play, You Will Get Sick. Mm-hmm. Thinking about that stark difference, what does that make you think of, or how does that make you feel?
Mm. In 2020, right before the pandemic, Wolf Play by Han Sol-jung almost performed or didn't get to perform in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
We had
Endlings, which didn't go
Endlings,
on.
Oh,
closed early.
I went twice and that closed early. Suicide Forest by
Haruna Lee
and directed by Aya was going to have its like second run of things as a co-pro, and that shuttered, and something else and something else. It felt like we were just on the cusp of getting to celebrate more than one, that there was more than one Asian American, Asian story being told, and how exhilarating that was. And then the pandemic stopped that. And I did really wonder, well, what will happen after we come back? Because I imagined that people would want comedies and that which is familiar in returning to the theater. And would we be ready to challenge or discomfort our audiences in the same ways that we were prior to, even though I find that always to be necessary? And would there be a season as rich as that coming up? And this year's announcement in particular, so the 2022 into 2023 season, feels like that echo of excitement I had in 2020 with the plays you mentioned. And it's already closed, but Primary Stages had Clarence Coos on that day in Amsterdam, and that was his New York debut. And Jihae Park's Peerless is happening right now, and that's her New York's debut, which feels absurd because Peerless has been done all over the country, and Hannah and the Dread Gazebo won every single playwriting award possible and has this like stunning OSF production that Che Yu directed that I would love to see in New York City someday. And she has all these plays that I hope get to see, or, you know, that we in New York get to experience.
I love her work. And it's stunning. Yeah.
Yeah. Then we have Julia Izuma. Izumi, yes. Mm-hmm. At Playwrights Horizons.
And K-pop on Broadway.
K-pop on Broadway. We're having Mia Chung's Catch as Catch Can also at Playwrights Horizons. And this time done with three Asian American actors instead of white actors.
Mm-hmm.
And Wolf Play is going to come back. So that is exciting. You know, we get to see these stories being told, and I'm always excited when we in the minority don't have to be burdened with telling a story with the majority's weight on our shoulders, that we can just tell the specificity and not feel like we are having to represent for the all. Like when Crazy Rich Asians came out and people were hating on it because that wasn't their experience, but that's telling a very specific experience and point of view, and that one movie shouldn't have to hold the burden of all of Asia America or all of China or all of Asia. And yet when we have so few, that's inadvertently what happens. And this year we have not few but many, and I just hope it continues in that direction.
I mean, yes, amen to that. I'm really excited about this season. I'm curious to hear about, so now that, you know, we've talked about this season and 2018, when did you come to New York, and what was starting your career like? You have some insane success right now, but was it easy for you to come to the theater, and did you know that it was going to be the thing?
I knew I wanted to move to New York because I wanted to pursue theater. I knew that it would be hard, and I remember printing a stack of resumes that were real world jobs, you know, like waiting tables, and I had worked in a costume shop and whatever that resume was versus actor resumes. And I went to UCSD for undergrad and graduated in 2009 and had the privilege of getting my equity card at La Jolla Playhouse. And so having an equity card at that time seemed to limit my options. Like I was warned by friends in Chicago that there weren't as many equity houses, let alone roles for Asian Americans, which is a whole other thing. But
what did you do at La Jolla? What got you your card?
I did a children's show called Miss Electricity.
Oh, okay.
And it was one of those where you traveled around to local schools and community centers and then ended back up at the theater. And during that quarter, UCSD's theater department created work-study classes so I could keep my scholarship funding. But I barely attended classes. I was just performing, which is very generous of them to do. But my first year at UCSD in 2005, I was cast in a play of, Blood Wedding, Lorca, and directed by Jerry Ruiz. And he'd moved to the New York City before I had, or had graduated before I had. And I actually sublet his room when I first moved to the city and lived in deep Queens for a month while I first got my bearings. And then later that year, within the first year, he asked if I would be interested in working at Repertorio Español, the Spanish Rep Theater in New York City, because there was a play that dealt with a Mexican-American family and a daughter who was dating a Japanese-American guy shortly after World War II. And so it had an interesting subplot with racial tensions between Mexican and Japanese populations, or racism inherent to a minority that was living in America. And, you know, we just come from the internment camps and such. So it was, it was just a romantic lead, actually, character side character in this family plot. And Jerry knew that I knew some Spanish, and also that this would be an opportunity for me. And that was my first show in the city. And then I can't figure out what my next theater thing would have been. Oh, maybe Disoriented by Kyung Park, that Carlos Armesto directed, that my first manager would have gotten me an audition for that. And they rented the space, the upstairs space at Playwrights Horizons, but it wasn't a Playwrights show, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And Carlos and Kyung and I would collaborate for years to come from there. But I guess if I look back, I don't seem to see a through line of what you call success or whatever momentum is. I remember an actor telling me it takes you, I forget the numbers, maybe 7 years for people to remember your name and 10 years to start using it. And that felt like a more pessimistic version of the other pithy quote of your feet are in rooms that you haven't even stepped foot in, or whatever that other one is that's meant to be inspiring. Not to take away anyone's joy or need for inspiration, but I feel like living proof of that in some ways. I've been here 13 years now, and I keep joking, but not joking about this, but it'll be my first playbill in New York City after 13 years of working here. And that's not to say I haven't been able to work at wonderful places, larger institutions and such, but as someone who keeps their playbills in a stack of binders behind your camera, I will finally have my name in one. And its own, I don't know, life accomplishment star.
That's incredible. Yeah. Wow. That just made me teary to think about. And I was also, as I was preparing for this interview, I pulled up this tweet that was, I think, much retweeted. Brian Kopelman said, he tweeted, "Daniel Isaac has been in every episode of Billions. That man turned a two-line part into 72 episodes and counting. Excellent actor, great human."
Wow. I can't name that tweet.
Yeah, dude. I mean, that's incredible. So you get cast in Billions in 2016?
I think I auditioned for that in December of 2014, and we shot the pilot very early 2015, and the rest of the season starting that summer. So if I can pinpoint a time in which things felt like they were changing, it would be 2015, where they kept writing for this smaller character in the first season. I still waited tables and bartended through season 2, so 2 years of shooting. And then around, I think it would be around season two, the restaurant quietly sort of let me go and didn't tell me. I just hadn't signed up for a shift in a while. And that holiday season, so what would that be, like 2016? Yeah, 2016, during the holidays, I thought I would pick up some shifts because who doesn't need more money around the holidays? And there was an app that you use to pick up shifts, and it said something like, you are no longer a registered employee here. And I took that as a sign from the universe, and have been fortunate not to go back to a survival job since. So if that's an indication of time, it took me seven years of survival jobs before I could solely subsist on just the artistry. And I'm fully aware of that could end at any time too. And so I'll just continue to appreciate when I don't have to.
Mm. And so to speak to what Brian tweeted and to that story, how did you turn a two-line part? Like, what do you think you did, or what is part of your practice to help you stay sane? I mean, it's a big deal to get cast on a big show like that, you know, not having done that before.
Yeah. I've been killed off of things and been promised things or been a part of pilots that didn't go. And so I took everything. By that time, I wouldn't say I was jaded, but I was experienced enough to know the business, and I wasn't going to take anything for granted. So that first season, we shot the pilot and the scene was with Damian Lewis. And I thought, well, if this is the only thing I shoot, that's cool. And a part of me is always an eternal optimist. And I hoped that, well, you've set up a new kid basically working for the company. I hope they continue with that. And they did, which surprised me. It wasn't huge story arcs, but they would write me a line or two every episode or even a funny or awkward or silly glance. And the way that season unfolded was, I remember I was doing a play called Underland at 59 East 59 by Alexandra Collier, directed by Mia Ravenio. And I got an email from my ex-manager saying, hey, they want to pin you for 102, 103, 105, something like that. Like, not, it wasn't even all sequential. And I thought, that's great. I have some episodes to come. And then while shooting, I would get another email saying, oh, they'll need you for 104 too. So keep those dates open. And they're going to pin you for 6, 8, and 9. And that kept happening until at the end of it, I thought, oh, I've done all 12. And I'm not a series regular. And so I just thought, that's cool. They kept me around. I got to learn by watching. I got to make new friends. It was like an education and a career achievement all at once. Because the show is populated with mostly middle to older aged actors who are just incredible, huge heavy hitters in their own career journeys, cast by Alison Estrin. And they are using the richest of New York City talent, I think, every season.
Seriously.
So even if I don't have a line in many of those early episodes, I just got to watch them work. And I got to learn what, you know, having five cameras running around and a giant crew and hundreds of background actors could feel like, and how to remain sane and centered and have fun. And also, I'm an ambivert, but really more, I'm an introvert, sometimes disguised as an extrovert. And so I could be an introvert and just laugh at people who are jokesters. You know, we have real stand-up comedians on the show, and also just enjoy getting to know people who are just doing it. I don't know how else to say it. To me, they're all famous, but I guess a way of putting it is, so many of these actors are just working actors, which to be just a working actor is an incredible privilege. I don't diminish that, but they're not people. They're not what I imagine a Marvel actor has to go through on a day-to-day basis, or the cast of Friends still today walking the streets must go through. And so these are people who I saw as my kind of lighthouse, that they had homes, they had long-term partners, they had a kid or several kids, and they had built a life and they knew how to do it. And it wasn't about celebrity or fame. It was about the work. And not that someone who pursues those other things not judging that, just these were working actors. And so I remember that first year thinking around that time. So 2015, I would have been in the city for six, seven years. And I thought, well, maybe I should go to grad school now. That mm-hmm. I promised myself I wouldn't go to grad school straight out of undergrad, because I felt like I wanted some sort of world education before going back to school. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that. And David Costable said, why the fuck would you go to grad school when you're on a show right now that people who go to grad school would kill to then go on and be on? You're mm-hmm. living the dream of what happens after you graduate, and you don't have to go to grad school for that. And I will always remember that. I mean, those aren't the exact quotes, but whatever. He told me, don't go to grad school. You're being stupid. Just work and learn from the job. And mm-hmm. I did. And I watched David Costable work for 7 years now. And that is its own masterclass and privilege. And Maggie Siff and Damian Lewis and Corey Stoll and Daniel Breaker and Paul Giamatti. Like, I get the front row seat that I don't think many people get a chance to get. And mm-hmm. I watch what ego or pride does, and I watch what humility does, and I watch how to be a leader, and I watch how to set a tone and how to carry oneself. I've learned so much from this family, and it'll be a huge chapter of my life, even though, you know, the sum of my storylines are not the primary thing of the show. Mm-hmm. I now have whatever 6 times 12 is, math.
72
episodes. And we are going to start shooting season 7. And I've never done 72 of anything, I don't think, right? I don't know if I've gone to the gym 72 times. It's like that. This is cool.
It's very cool. It's so cool. It's incredible to hear you talk about it, because I think an actor in maybe a lesser, not judging, but I think it can also be easy to get frustrated sometimes, I think. Mm-hmm. So to hear you talk about this with such amazing grace is really incredibly, I don't know, inspirational and heartening and beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll always be grateful to them that I was a no-name actor with no additive value other than what I had to offer as far as my toolbox of ability was concerned. But they came in hard with huge names to try to make a successful show, which I think any show that reaches past a season has to be a measure of success. And and they chose, Brian Koppelman and David Levine and the writer's room and such, continue to choose to include this character. And even in recognizing the introvert in me, wrote a storyline about coming out of your shell and needing to take up more space, and what an evolution from being the new guy and being the humbled one to being more of a leader could look like. And, you know, I joke because I don't have a dad, and I always jokingly call them dads to me. It was like they were giving a dad lesson through my character. And they've done that a handful of times over the years. So
I didn't know that. I don't have a dad either. Not to trauma bond, but
no, yeah, I don't have a dad. You know,
that's amazing.
No, my mom jokes whenever I have a print ad campaign, which I haven't had in a while, but I used to have one for Bank of America. That was one of my first big print campaigns. You know, when people think you're more famous for a print campaign than from the actual work you've been doing on stage or on screen for your, anyway.
Right. They're like, I know you. They're like, I've seen
one,
you.
That one means you've made it. So Bank of America. And I think I did one for Grubhub or Seamless or something like that. And whenever I've had a larger print campaign, because I am an Asian bodied person, they usually put it in Asian centric neighborhoods, you know, Koreatowns or Chinatowns or whatnot. And so my mom found one. She's found them in multiple things like Korean newspapers and in Koreatown. And she likes to joke. And this is, I have to reiterate that it is a joke, but people will awe when they hear this. She'll say, your father has seen this and does not recognize who you are, because that's how long it's been, which is, I find very funny to think, oh, you have a child that you have no idea is yours, because unless I post a series of pictures of me from, like, you know, like yearbook pictures to show how I've evolved to what I look like today, this man has no idea who I am. And that's like a mind-blowing and hilarious thing, and a dark joke that my mom and I make to one another.
Well, as somebody whose father found her on Facebook at the age of 23, I'll have to say, which I also think is hilarious. Mm-hmm. I have to say, you know, both are weird. And mm-hmm. Yeah, fathers, man, they're out there. And maybe they'll find you one day. You never know.
Maybe they will. And maybe they won't.
And maybe they won't. Yeah.
That's fine.
To speak about that, you have this project in development called According to My Mother.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up with a single mom?
Mm-hmm. Only child, single mom. Yeah.
Dude, me too.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
No way. And immigrant single mom too?
Yeah. I immigrated here. I immigrated here.
Oh, you
here.
Did? Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
You were born
how
here?
Old? Yeah, I was born here. How old were you when you came to America?
I was like 7 or 8.
Was it enough to remember enough of motherland versus, or did you quickly assimilate and like lose the ability to speak language and whatnot?
Well, my motherland is England. So,
oh, wow.
So,
I made a microaggression assuming you came from an Asian heritage place. Wait, so then was it just dropping a British accent?
Yeah, well, I had a British accent. I spoke English. And then I moved to like Chinatown in Brooklyn, and everybody around me was Chinese, including like the people who were then raising me, like my grandparents. So they're like, you idiot child, you can't speak Chinese. Like, and then so it was like kind of a reverse immigration situation.
That's so funny. Did you get bullied for having an English accent?
I did. I lost it real fast.
I can totally see that. I can see New Yorkers especially being like, that sounds pretentious as fuck. You will get rid of that.
Yeah. And also, but I'm also living in an immigrant community. So like there are a million accents in the class. Yeah, like there's like the Guyanese girl and like, you know, thick Staten Island accents. And they're all like, you sound dumb as hell. And I'm like, okay, like, sorry, guys.
I'll work on it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, that's cool. When you told your mom, did you have to like come out to her as a theater maker? And then I know you write about this a lot, your sexuality as well. Like, were there two kind of coming out?
She is a tiger mom. I can say that. Other people can't say that. And she is extremely conservative about some things. But something I will always give her credit for is that she's the one who introduced me to the arts and to the theater. And so I have a different experience of having an immigrant parent that usually wouldn't want their child to pursue the arts, especially for, say, financial security or fear-based reasons after the sacrifices immigrants make to build lives for their families in hopes that future generations won't have to go through the struggles they did. My mother was able to let go of that fear, and she actually pushed me to pursue theater, thinking that that's a space where I would grow socially, but also the necessary tools of speaking in public, and that which you had to be able to do on stage is a necessary life skill that she knew she couldn't teach me. And so she's the one who introduced me to theater. And so when I stubbornly decided to stay in it, there was no one to blame but herself. And she pivoted rather quickly and thought, then fine, you will become a famous actor who will use your platform to spread the gospel of Christianity. And I have achieved none of those things, but I am a working actor. Much to her chagrin or something. She doesn't think I'll ever be successful or famous. And what her barometers are quite funny, but they include being on the billboard of the TV show you're on or movie you're in that is either a huge blockbuster or on network TV. So even if I was on a Billions Showtime poster, it wouldn't count.
You are, aren't you? Yes, you are.
I've never been in like cover art, but I've been in art for it.
Okay. This is an extremely specific.
It's so specific. It's requirement. So old too, because like if I was on CBS, which is the parent company, then it would be real. But because it's Showtime and you have to pay to watch it, she thinks that's not real. And I've tried to pay for her cable and say, like, we're living in the golden age of television that doesn't exist usually on network TV, minus like Abbott Elementary. You don't get it. And she'll fight me on it. So I'm not successful to her.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Mom. How did yours take it?
I mean, it was like a major, you know, I mean, the reason that I am an actor is because she was like, you're not allowed to be an actor. And I was like, fuck you, bitch. Yeah. In high school. And so now I'm, rebellious. And then I just stubbornly stayed on the path.
Uh-huh.
But I was on a network show, not on the poster, but last year. And my mom in the car one day was just like, just so you know, you're not a big star. You have a, like, you're not a big deal. You still need to do X, Y, and Z. And I was like, dude, I know. Like, come on. Asian moms.
Oh, God. They really love to humble us.
Yeah. Yeah. Keeping us humble.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had so many more things I want to talk to you about, but I'm running out of time. So I want to very quickly mention that you narrated one of my favorite books this year, which I discovered while I was researching you.
Which one?
How to Write an Autobiography by Alexander Chi.
Oh, he's so amazing. How to Write an Autobiographical
Novel.
How to Write an Autobiographical Novel by Alexander Chi. Yeah.
Yes.
Right?
It's yes.
Behind me somewhere.
So how did you end up getting that gig?
Alex and I met years ago. Oh, I know exactly how. Cindy Chung, beloved theater royalty, Cindy Chung, was doing a one-woman show. I went with my friend. Oh, this sounds like name dropping, but it's not. It's because B.D. Wong and I met at La Jolla Playhouse. Oh, look, we've come full circle.
Wow.
At my last year of undergrad. And when I moved to the city, I reached out and said, hey, I'm a new Asian American actor in the city. Do you have any advice? And he said, let me feed you and give you some used winter clothes.
Oh, and, my God. B.D. Wong is amazing. Yes. An angel. Yes, I didn't know truly. That. Should I reach out to him now? Just kidding.
Okay. I know, right?
I'm a struggling actor.
He took me to go see Cindy's show, or he directed it. He also directed it, of course. That's the connection. And Alex attended that, gave a copy of his book. Oh, and Alex knows Cindy because Cindy's husband, Ed Lin, is also an incredible author. And I think that's where the connection first started. I could be wrong. They'll correct me if I'm wrong or if they ever listen to this. But Alex gave BD a copy of his first book, Edinburgh, and BD handed it to me. And I didn't know a lot of people then. So I just kind of like sat in the corner and started reading it. And then I got my own copy later and devoured it. And that is a very difficult and heavy and beautiful read. And Alex and I became friends from that. I wonder how I would have reached out to him again. I recall that we had martinis once, him and his partner and I, and I was so excited being around them that I drank too much of it, and I definitely had to throw up.
Oh, no, from one martini?
No, from like many, many, many martinis, just like no one should have many, many, many martinis. I think you can have many, many martinis, but yeah, I was young. Anyway, we were friends, and when How to Write an Autobiographical Novel was, and deservedly so, a huge success. I feel like that was around the time when audiobooks were becoming bigger too. And the trend would have been for the author to narrate themselves. And Alex said that the publishers wouldn't let him. So then he sent me one of the chapters and said, would you just record this on your iPhone? And we'll see if they'll have you do it, because Alex and I are both Korean American queer men, cis men, and I've always felt huge empathy vibrations with him. And Alex advocated for me to be his audiobook narrator. And that was my first job. And that single-handedly opened up other jobs. I mean, they also retroactively then did Edinburgh. And so then Alex gave me two jobs in that capacity. And then also I was able to, you know, then say I'm an audiobook narrator, and I've gotten frequent work since, and I love it, getting paid to read. I'm a huge nerd. You see all these books behind me. Like, I can't believe, I feel like I've gotten away with something when I get to be paid to read something. So, yeah.
And I know, like, I love when you post about the books you read, because you have the best taste in books. So I'm always like, oh, what's that Daniel reading?
I'm a little behind on my reading, but I do love it. So, yeah.
I would call your mom and tell her that you're a star. what's like your hope? What's the big dream? Where do you hope this all leads?
The dream includes the nightmare, which is I hope to never have to go back to a, what did I call it? I call them survival jobs. I would love to just be able to live in the artistry. And I have since whatever, 2016 or 2017, but the pandemic reminded me this can go away at any time. And so I continue to dream that and summon that for my future. The dream of dreams is I've never done a Broadway show. That would be really a cool life achievement. And I'd really love to make this TV show about my mom, and I'll just be patient and see if and when that happens. I really felt incredible many things when having my playwriting debut, and so I hope more plays of mine get done and that I get to continue pursuing this job of being an artist that acts and writes. And I think I secretly wish to direct too, but I want sort of more time before I do that. But maybe now people think I'm old and I can do that. I don't know. I just want to keep working. And I love the balance that I've been able to have over the years, which is doing billions, you know, a season of shooting and then fitting in a theater project in the hiatus. That pattern is a true gift that I don't take lightly. So to continue to do that would be great. I just, I don't know what's next. We'll shoot Billion season 7, and then I have no idea what happens after that. So I'll just dream that there's other stuff to come.
And do you have a secret for your productivity? Because we didn't even talk about your writing. Like, how do you fit it all in? Is there stuff you do, practices, or things you don't do that help you write?
I think my creative writing is rather, it comes in fits and bursts. And if anything, I just have to be patient with myself, because it sometimes feels like a nagging thing in the back of my head that feels like a homework assignment that you are, you know, like the long-term project that I always neglected until the very last minute. That's oftentimes what I feel in my writing. And I'm trying to give myself more grace for that and to not fall in the capitalist model of productivity. What has helped me and what I am thankful for are writers groups like Ensemble Studio Theater's Young Blood and Page 73's Interstate 73 and Mai Theater Company. They're an Asian American writers group. And New York Theater Workshop has a Mondays at 3 reading series. You know, these places helped develop my play that ultimately was produced. Oh, and Space on Writer Farm. They've given me space and time and accountability and fellowship in the writing, because writing can feel so fucking lonely. So when you're in a group, if you can maneuver around toxic competitiveness and whatever terrible infrastructures might exist, because all companies need to have a reckoning, I think. I'm not saying that about the companies I'm in. I just mean like theater writ large and the arts institutions and how we need to compensate our artists and such. And that creative time is never compensated properly, perhaps. I say the groups work for me. I say I'm not a rigorous wake up in the morning and write kind of person, but I do listen when I feel an urge to, and that happens at weird hours or on the subway or at an inconvenient time, but I try to listen. My friend Keeley Gibson calls it listening to the muse, and when the muse calls, you have to respond, or else you'll lose it and the muse will give it to someone else instead. And lastly, I do morning pages, which is a practice from Julia Cameron's The Artist Way. And that's just waking up in the morning. And the first thing you should do is write 3 pages freehand. And admittedly, I still sort of doom scroll in the morning, and it's hard for me to get out of bed, or I snooze instead of doing that often. But I try to maintain that practice. And the point is not for product. It is just to write. And most often it is journaling or sort of stream of consciousness for me and grocery lists or whatever, or doodles. But I'm pretty sure that practice is feeding my creative voice too. And I'm just trusting in that, even if I'm not writing scenes or outlines or scripts in those 3 pages, because they're not supposed to be product. They're just supposed to be process. So the latter I recommend the most.
Cool. Cool. I'm inspired. You're an inspiration. Thank you.
Thank you for saying so.
So much.
I don't, it's hard to, whatever. I'm working on just saying thank you. Thank you.
That was Daniel K. Isaac. No joke, I started doing morning pages immediately after having this conversation. I'm like, whatever that man is doing, I gotta start doing. I hope you also got a lot out of this conversation. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, have a great day.